cliffcentral.com.
Okay, so let's get onto this, because this is the real elephant in the room. I mean, we left here, Canton, couldn't really talk about the situation at ENCA when you left. You hadn't left at that stage. But I think people just want to know, like, where are we? Are you okay? What's been happening? Because, you know, a lot of people who listen to you for a year now want to just know what's going on. So put it in the simplest terms possible, in your own words.
The simplest terms possible, you know that... We never spoke about ENCA at all on this show.
No.
From the get-go. And the point is, I was taken in on a short-term contract, and we parted ways amicably.
Oh, okay.
So whatever you might have heard...
There was controversy.
Yes, of course there's controversy. And Twitter was the controversy. But the fact of the matter is, we parted ways amicably.
Okay.
And one of the other things that you'll find if you look across my career is that... You will never find at any point there has been any engagement on my part in terms of what I thought about former employers at any level. And just simply because I think that that's not good manners. Because it's just the way. So,
and what about employees?
Even employees. You know, employees, I have, you know, the entire point around you are there in terms of essentially a legal relationship.
Yeah.
And at the point at which you are engaging with them on the basis of that legal relationship, there are legal issues that actually pop up there. The only point at which you're in a position to end up talking about it is when that person is dead, pretty much. Mm. So now if you ask me what actually went down with Vukani Masinga, also known as Chili M, you know, I'll be able to tell you, yes, it's absolutely true that I frog-marched him into rehab.
But
my point is that I would never go into that if the guy is still alive because of the fact that you don't talk about...
Well, some people don't have those kind of misgivings. Some people piled on. I mean, people were saying, you're a terrible boss, you're a horrible person. There were a lot of people who came out of the woodwork from nowhere.
Absolutely.
Who suddenly had something to say.
And no doubt they'll continue to do so.
Okay.
And do I care? No, not particularly. For everyone who turns around and says that I was a horrible boss, it probably means that I was holding them accountable to their job description. And by the same token, there are literally hundreds of people who will turn around and say, yes, Kanthan put me through training and Kanthan working for him was the best thing that ever happened to me.
Okay.
And I'm very comfortable with that scenario.
And you are not unemployed and sitting out there desperate... with a piece of cardboard on William Nicol, like some people were hoping you would be.
Isn't sitting with a piece of cardboard on William Nicol actually a form of employment because people pay you to do so?
So you are sitting on William Nicol with a piece of
Guys, I've just come back from a 5-day holiday in Cape Town.
You haven't thought about it yet.
You know, I've just come back from a 5-day holiday in Cape Town.
People are asking this, and there's nothing worse than everybody talking about you when you haven't been able to say anything yourself. I know this feeling.
What would you like me to venture at this point?
You know, for the people who listen to you here,
yes,
who know you in terms of your opinions, your point of view on a lot of current affairs things, your point of view on the job world, the economy, they might be curious about this stuff. You're going to say, wait and see.
I'm going to say, wait and see. That's exactly right. But remember that generally I don't talk about stuff that I do behind the scenes. So
you also don't talk much about family and that kind of thing because it's none of everybody else's business.
Exactly. But at the point at which I started with the NCA, and I started with the NCA on the 9th of October, I was given very specific goals in terms of needing to push up ratings, which were very successful, and I've got the figures to prove it.
Okay.
So as far as I'm concerned, I was hired to do a specific thing.
So let's recap.
Yeah.
You raised the ratings.
Yes.
You're a horrible boss.
I'm a horrible boss.
You're a racist.
Absolutely, I'm a racist. You know, I stand up for my species, the human race. You know?
Okay, let's turn our attention to the most important story in the world. Because people who are in the government bubble in South Africa do think this is the most important story in the world. The ANC's 108th birthday celebrations go into full swing across the Northern Cape, the most important province in South Africa, with President Cyril Ramaphosa, who's promised the community of Galeshewe in Kimberley a renewed party. Let's all just raise our voices and our hands in awe and support and give them a resounding round of applause. I mean, this is just marvelous. Well done. ANC 108th birthday. What a terrific thing to celebrate.
In December, he also promised us no load shedding till the 13th of January.
You had to climb in with your barbs and your hooks and your claws.
No,
straight
I'm
away.
Just saying. I'm
yes,
just
you hate him.
I don't. I am actually very sad for the man.
I saw your tweet, actually.
Yeah, because
explain yourself, Bumi.
Gareth, he promised us no load shedding till the 13th of January. And people were hopeful and people were happy. And I was skeptical.
Sure.
And Canton went a long way to assure me, to reassure me that this is not such a far-fetched thing that he can promise us. Ne?
Correct.
Because December, we use less power.
Absolutely.
And then, on Sunday, the 5th of January, we are all greeted by what? Notices. Of load shedding. I'm like, what? Another week he could have delivered on a particular...
People went back to work early.
He could have promised, you know, another week he could have delivered on one promise. And then some faith would have been restored for all of us that this guy can promise us things and deliver on those things. And now...
More broken promises. But you finished your tweet by saying he must be very shocked. He's always shocked.
He is.
Everything shocks this president.
And, you know, I mean...
So, at least
so he's now he's promising us a renewed party. How are we to believe that? Mm.
Well, he's busy organizing the celebrations along with the rest of the ANC. They are celebrating their ability to retain political power since the advent of democracy. He admitted that there were negative elements that the ANC was working hard to rid itself of. It's an understatement. While many who showed up for the ceremony could not find room in the Maibuye Community Hall... in Galeshewe to share the moment, the president reassured them the ANC's birthday was as momentous for them. Even if you couldn't get in and get some cake.
You know what? It's shame, man. The grand gestures that they are clinging on to. Every year, like, big, we're going to have a big celebration. For grand gestures, even on a human level, right? We all celebrate milestones, or try to. When you turn 40, you have a big party. When you turn 41, you do not.
Yes. Right? So 108.
Why are they having trying so hard to have all these big grand? Because there's nothing else there. The substance.
It's empty. And here's the point.
Guys, I have nothing to contribute to this discussion.
No, but I want to tell you why I brought this up, because there is a story related to this. The ANC celebrating their 108th birthday in Kimberley. The 600 employees at the party's headquarters and provincial structures are facing a battle over salaries, as we're talking about their birthday. In December, the party's general manager, Febe Potgieter Kubule, informed employees that the party could not afford to pay salaries. This is in December. You tell your people who work for you in December that you're not going to pay them. The salaries, which are expected before the 12th of December, came 2 days after Christmas. But they were worried they wouldn't come at all. Sources inside the ANC's treasury have revealed to the independent media that the party may not be able to pay January and February salaries. So this is why they have grand gestures, Pumi, to answer your question, because clearly they can't even pay the people who work for the party in the place they're celebrating the birthday.
They have 600 employees, no? And how many people do they have in parliament? I think their political solution is the people they have in parliament should donate half their salaries to the people that are working at Luthuli House.
Well, I was talking to a friend of mine who is an ANC MP. And we've known each other for a long time. And we started talking on Sunday on WhatsApp because he sent me a story, you know, like press release style.
No names will be mentioned.
No.
These are not like the delinquents that Mbulelo won't tell us about.
But I said to him in one of our interchanges, I said to him, you know, the people of Iran, for example, good people, they're trying desperately to live their lives, but their government are assholes. They don't tolerate opposition. You know, there's no such thing as opposition in Iran. They cracked down very hard on the students only 2 years ago when there was that supposed green revolution, which never materialized. And it's quite a brutal society outside of peacetime. And the Ayatollahs are hardly the most forgiving people in the world. And I said, you know, the problem is the people are good. government are assholes. And he immediately got defensive and said, are you calling
us assholes?
Because I said, you know, just like here. And he said, oh, are you calling us assholes? But this is how the people in the ANC in government feel. They feel that they are marveled at by this the society, that no one has punctured that bubble of theirs to show them the ugly truth that most people don't care. And I said to him, do you realize only 12 million people voted for you in the last election out of a population of close to 60 million? That's a small minority of people. And that does not mean that we're all in awe and waiting for government to propose some brilliant plan to pull us out of our misery. Actually, we're mostly getting on with our lives and figuring it out ourselves. That's the truth. And for this year, don't you think that should be our theme? It's like, how do we get away from big government? How do we make ourselves more independent? How do we forge a country and make an economy without the say-so of these apparatchiks and bureaucrats? Don't you think?
Again, I said earlier, I have nothing to contribute to this discussion. You know fully that I'm committed to going off-grid in every way possible. And essentially what that means is completely cutting dependence on government.
Yeah, and I looked into that, Kent, and I mentioned it this morning. It's very expensive to go off-grid.
Yes.
But it's worth it, you say?
Well, it's even more expensive to not be connected.
That's true. Yes. All right, so let's move on to things you do want to contribute to. Locally, politically, anything that's piqued your interest over the last little while?
Well, I was listening to your discussion with Pumi in the previous hour about the killing of
Soleimani.
Of Soleimani. Yes.
Okay, so let's go international first.
Yeah, let's.
What did you tweet about unilateral executions started with?
Yes, at the point that it actually went extrajudicial executions. Mm. Yeah, started with Obama going after Bin Laden.
And then later on,
and the point is that the can of worms was, well, firstly, there was the hysteria on the part of people that Trump had actually taken out someone using extrajudicial execution. But this is something that really started under Obama. It's, the BBC uses this euphemism of targeted killings. Mm-hmm. They're assassinations. Let's just call them what it is. They are assassinations. But it wasn't something that was invented by Trump. It was actually something that started back then. Do I approve of extrajudicial executions? No, I don't. Because I think what separates us from the murdering thugs in the Arab world is rule of law. And at the point at which we arbitrarily decide, just simply because we have the military capability to be able to subvert the rule of law, then we are on a slippery slope. Because how then do you ensure that there is actually due process? You know, the entire principles of natural justice, where people have the right to face their accusers, to have evidence presented, to be able to present a defense, all of those things are what really define us as
people's
a civilization.
People's motivations here are not the motivations that you're outlining here. I mean, let's quote Hillary Clinton quickly.
So, I mean, that is the land of unconfirmed riches. We came, we saw, he died.
That was what she said when Gaddafi was taken out. We came, we saw, he died. She didn't seem to need to apologize for that, the way that you'd see wheedling people in the media and in the Democratic Party asking Trump to go through all of these procedures. Yeah, not because they have a principal problem with this.
You see, except we're talking about different things. Now, let's just go back a bit into the history of Iran. Okay, up until the mid-50s, Iran was a thriving secular democracy.
Absolutely.
What happens in the mid-50s? Persia. Yeah, what happens in the mid-50s? CIA topples the government and institutes a dictatorship in order to gain access to the law, to the oil. There then comes a process where there's increased democratization that happens in Iran. And again, it becomes a thriving secular society until come the 70s. What happens?
The Shah is removed.
No, the Shah is installed by the CIA.
Correct.
And who puts in one of the most tyrannical regimes possible, which then leads to an uprising on the part of the Iranian people, which then gets hijacked by the Ayatollahs. Mm-hmm. So twice you've had a situation where the people of Iran were happily getting on with their lives, and along comes the US and topples their governments. So this entire idea that the Ayatollahs are something that just spontaneously emerged is rubbish. It actually was exactly the type of scenario that we've had in every country where regime change has been effected. What happens? You have people who come in who are tyrannical and then start imposing these really absurd orders upon the people of those countries. And really, people turn around and say that Obama allowed them to get away. No, actually, what Obama did was he ring-fenced them. And Obama, by signing that deal, he was effectively ensuring that there was ongoing access so that these guys would not be able to do uranium enrichment that was going to give them a pathway to a nuclear weapon. So that meant that inspectors could come and go from Iran pretty much as they felt. And remember all of this hysteria right now about Iran practicing cyber warfare. No, actually, it was Obama who brilliantly, I must say, in terms of cyber warfare, managed to take out all of the centrifuges at all of the Iranian enrichment facilities and effectively shut them down by running viruses among them. There's a fascinating...
That's right, I remember that.
Yes. Now, Iran was effectively contained. Trump then turned around and said, no, actually, we have a problem out here because in 15 years' time, Iran will be able to start...
How can you say they were contained when the Soleimani was in charge of making sure that there was trouble in Syria, Iraq, Lebanon,
now,
Yemen?
Now let's talk about trouble in
I mean, this is terrorism. Exporting terrorism.
Absolutely not. If we look in terms of what went down in terms of Syria, if you want the single reason why ISIS was taken out, it was Soleimani.
Not the Kurds?
Not the Kurds. Absolutely not the Kurds. It was the Iranians who, because remember that ISIS was a signal threat to the Shias.
Yeah.
Okay. The ISIS were trying, absolutely. ISIS was trying its best to resurrect a Sunni caliphate, and they were committed to the utter destruction of Iran. Iran lost thousands of troops fighting ISIS. And if you want to know the single reason why ISIS was eventually contained and driven out of Syria, it was because of the fact that the Iranians actually said, this is a disaster that is sitting right here, and we need to sort it out. And they went after them. And in fact, I tweeted a link to a Reuters piece from back in 2017 that talked about the circumstances under which...
But their support of Hezbollah...
Their support of Hezbollah.
They're the backbone of Hezbollah.
They are the backbone of Hezbollah. Exactly right.
Or they provide an international terrorist organization.
They provide support to Hezbollah. Absolutely correct. But in the context of what we are talking about around Syria, around the obliteration of ISIS, that's a different thing. Now, when we're talking about supporting of terrorism, okay, let's talk about the White Helmets. You familiar with the White Helmets?
Was this UN?
No. The White Helmets was this group that was funded by the UK and the US specifically to destabilize Syria. And if you want to know why the refugee crisis actually started in Syria in the first place, it was because of that fact. There were hundreds of thousands of pounds that the UK government was pouring into support of these guys. And these were ISIS thugs.
But we know... So Syria is very complicated because we've got the Russians involved.
I'm saying
the
Middle East is complicated. Now, the only reason why Syria is not a basket case today... It is not a basket case in the same way as Libya. It is not a basket case in the same way as Iraq is. Because remember that these were all stable societies, admittedly under dictatorships.
Yeah,
but they were stable.
Tyrants.
Yes, they were under tyrannical dictatorships. But at the point at which there was military intervention that actually took place there, that core stability within those societies absolutely disintegrated.
Yeah.
Now, if you look in terms of the stuff that I was talking about yesterday...
So you're saying, just to join the dots here then, you're saying that the fact that Assad is still there is a good thing?
I'm saying that the fact that Assad is still there is a good thing compared to not having Assad there. It's like saying that not having Gaddafi there is worse than having Gaddafi there.
Right.
Because there was stability within those societies. People were not dying on a day-to-day basis. Yes, they were tyrannical regimes. But my entire point is that we need to just basically shut off the Arab world from the rest of the civilized world until they learn to play by the rules of engagement with the civilized world, and then we let them back in.
And to be clear, the Persians, the Iranians, are not in the Arab world, but they have a stake in it.
No, I refer to the Persians, to them as being part of the Arab world.
Well, they definitely wouldn't like to be called Arabs.
Yes, I know, but, you know, that's fine. They all look the same to me.
Sure, such a sweeping statement.
Let me go back to something that I was... let me go back to saying... a point that I was making yesterday.
Uh-huh.
Okay, understand that there are no good guys in any of these countries. I'm talking in terms of Saudi Arabia. I'm talking about United Arab Emirates. I'm talking in terms of Yemen. I'm talking in terms of Syria. All of these places, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, there are no good guys out there. They are all theocratic shitholes. Mm.
No, that's the truth.
Okay. What we then need to look at is there a hierarchy in terms of some places being worse than other places? And my point fundamentally is, would I rather live in Iran than Saudi Arabia? Yes.
Hmm.
Now, if you use that as your starting point, you understand why this entire argument around what goes on in the Middle East is entirely devoid of nuance. Because there is this entire thing about relative hellholes.
Mm.
And in terms of relative hellholes, Saudi is absolutely the worst hellhole for me in terms of women's rights, in terms of gay rights, in terms of
personal freedoms,
personal freedom, rule of law. Iran is better than Saudi at that level. The United Arab Emirates is better than Iran at that level. Would I want to live in any of those places? Fuck no.
Pums, you've been sitting here quietly laughing and smiling and sometimes not so happy about the things he's saying. You agree?
No, because as you know, Kenton and I often have differing views.
Hugely.
But on this we agree. This is my thing about people must be allowed to, like over there, govern or misgovern themselves.
But unfortunately, guys,
remember we got into quite a heated conversation about Iran.
US, yeah.
And living in Iran.
Yeah.
In an environment where for those people they were living. People are living there. It may not be your cup of tea,
but it works for them. You two are making no sense to me because you're imagining that this is a place you can seal off and just let them have their own way about things, and it's not going to have an impact in the rest of the world. Things like oil, which in the European context, I mean, Trump proudly said we're energy independent, and he's right. They've got enough energy in America that they don't need the Middle East, but Europe does. And then there's a Russian interest because the Russians also have a stake in this game. And then there's the Chinese who also have a stake in this. So there are lots of players here that involve all of us, whether we want to be or not. You can't just pretend that doesn't happen.
You have to understand that the fundamental underpinnings of the entire Middle East conflicts tie back to one thing and one thing only. And that is our use of the US dollar as the world's reserve currency.
And
remember at the time that we abandoned the gold standard?
Yes.
When all currencies became free floating against each other.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the only reason why the US dollar has any intrinsic value, you know, because back in the day you could actually exchange your dollars or your South African rands for gold.
Yes.
And that's no longer the case. But the US dollar is the only currency in the world that has intrinsic value. And the reason for that is because you use the US dollar to buy oil. And at the point at which the US dollar is no longer able to be freely exchanged for oil, it actually loses its value. And the impetus then on the part of successive American governments to ensure the hegemony of the US dollar has to be paramount. And if you consider what happens any time anyone says, actually, we're going to turn around and we're going to accept payment in currencies other than the US dollar for oil, regime change immediately follows. So what was the point at which Saddam Hussein got taken out? He went to the UN Oil for Food program. And he said, well, actually, we want to be paid in euros going forward.
Hmm.
And suddenly what happens? Boom.
But it sounds like a conspiracy theory.
It's not a conspiracy theory.
It sounds like
the truth.
Sounds like one of those grand.
It's not a conspiracy. If I was the U.S. government, I would be doing exactly this.
What do you see as a solution?
The solution.
Forward?
Look, in the long term, here's what's going to happen. We're going to cut our dependence on oil.
Right.
Okay. And it's already happening. But what is true is that in the interim, in order to maintain the price of oil at the current levels, how do you do that? You limit the supply. So you remove significant players from the market. So Iran is a hugely significant player in the market. Venezuela is a hugely significant player in the market. By removing those two major sources from the market, what do?
You constrain
the supply. You chase up the price of oil. In the meanwhile, what the Saudis have been doing is they've been monetizing their stuff at a rate that has previously not been seen. Saudi Aramco right now is... It's the world's biggest company.
Yeah, in terms of capital.
In terms of capital, right. Yes. And the entire... Why do the Saudis actually take Aramco and...
List it?
It's to raise funds. What are they doing with those funds? They are taking those funds and investing it into everything else that's going to generate revenue after oil is no longer a revenue generator. So we're going to see a process of conflict that's going to play itself out probably for at least the next decade, where in order to ensure that the flow of money in the direction of the Saudis is actually kept up, you are going to see constant ring fencing by economic sanctions, primarily against Venezuela, against Iran, and against against Russia. Yeah. Russia is able to actually cock snook in the direction of the US because of the fact that they're able to trade with the likes of China in local currencies, which they are currently doing. Trump was very clear when he said, we're pulling out of Syria, but we're not pulling out of the oil fields. Those oil fields are ours. No, it's not his oil fields, but he's very clear.
We're going to take their oil.
He's very clear that, yes, he's not going to go in there and take the oil, but he's going to ensure that the Syrians are not in a position to actually exploit that oil. And then coming out of that, you'll see why there is pressure on things like Bitcoin or on cryptocurrencies in general, because of the fact that they fall outside of the monetary system. So this entire process is going to play itself out over the next decade.
By the way, what do you see happening with cryptocurrencies, since we're doing a bit of a Nostradamus, let's go see what happens in the next decade?
Well, there's been an interesting spike over the past, ever since the currencies came under pressure, immediately cryptos spiked.
But we're not talking a major spike. It's still like $7,900 a Bitcoin.
No, if we talk spikes in terms of percentages, let's just do a quick assessment in terms of how this stuff actually went down yesterday. Because I do know that I have, we're currently sitting at $8,350 US dollars.
Okay.
So if you... consider a correlation between instability on the financial markets and people turning to alternates. So the price of gold immediately spiked.
Mm-hmm.
The price of palladium immediately spiked. And the price of cryptos immediately spiked. So every time you have instability, you are going to have people rushing to push money into what they'd consider to be safe havens. And that's going to continue happening. Cryptos are going to continue to grow. And the reason why they're going to continue to grow is that money wants to be free.
Right.
And everyone wants the ability to be able to just shift money across borders as they see fit.
It's their money.
Yes.
All right, let's just turn our attention.
That's why Facebook getting into the crypto business is also something that everybody's like eyeing with a side eye. Because Facebook has the market. Facebook has the people. If all those people that are on Facebook who are interfacing on Facebook Marketplace then unpeg themselves from everybody else's currency.
That'll be interesting.
Suddenly, that Mark Zuckerberg. Hey?
By the way, have we made any progress on that? What do they call it, Libra?
They're supposed to be. The biggest news that I've seen over the past couple of days in that crypto world is also just is about how volatile it is, and because it's getting ready for this bull run because of what's happening in Iran, everybody is surging towards it because they. One, gold is surging, so we've seen a huge run on gold in the past couple of days, and the cryptocurrency. But now they're all talking about halving the value of it and halving the number of cryptocurrencies that are allowed in there and what they're producing and putting out into the market. And all of that is about the price volatility. And again, like Anthony is saying, everybody's worried about what's happening with the American dollar and what's happening with oil, and everybody wants to free themselves from what they see as...
You don't want to be tied to the misfortunes of other things. Yeah.
But, and Bitcoin and Rand prices, you know, I'm just checking over the past week, went from a low of 105,000 to a high of 128,000.
Okay.
Now, that's huge by any standard.
All right. We've got to turn our attention. I know you guys are totally uninspired by the local front, but let's just look at what this year might... bring for us. And I know that it's not an election year in South Africa, but there are political goings on. Do you think it's going to be more of the same? Are you excited about any prospects this year on the political or the economic or the social front?
Yeah, look, let's just go back to something that you were talking about earlier. And, you know, you're telling your friend at the ANC that, you know, there are only 12 million people who ended up voting for them.
Mm.
Now, the bigger issue for me is not that there are only 12 million people who voted this ANC government into power, but that there has not been a credible alternative that has been able to capture the minds of sufficient voters to get them to turn out in their numbers.
And to your credit, you even tried to present such a thing.
Yeah, and I think it certainly spiked imagination at that particular point, which was a good thing. It actually shook up that particular market.
But at least you put your money where your mouth was.
Yeah, but the crucial thing that if we look at the year ahead, well, there's a couple of major things that are going to be happening. The first thing, obviously, is going to be in terms of the budget speech that comes down next month. And the ratings agencies are going to be looking to that with much attention. And that is going to be, I think, a significant watershed for us.
Now, there are two ways it could go. If Tito manages to piece together a budget, because he's between a rock and a hard place in terms of income, right, Pumi? He doesn't have a lot of income streams.
No, he doesn't.
Yeah, not
in fact, I read an article over the holidays about the fact that SARS are expecting to bring in only a third of what they brought in the previous year because so many companies have declared losses and so many companies have gone under. Personal income tax is lower than it's ever been in terms of the number of people who can actually pay it. So people are not making the kind of money they made before. So this is putting a pinch on government in a big way.
Absolutely.
So number one is if he does this, if he tries to cobble together a budget which shows that they have ideas which will reap rewards and that will actually grow the economy, the ratings agencies might be persuaded not to downgrade us so much. Or they'll look at it and go, this is more pie in the sky. Sorry, guys, we can't take out government bonds with you anymore.
Well, something that was significant for me, if you take a look at, because we were all obsessing about Moody's last time around, but S&P just did their rating, and which happened within the past 3 weeks, as I recall.
Mm.
But they left our rating unchanged.
Okay.
So they didn't further downgrade us, which they could have done.
Small mercies.
It is small mercies. Mm. Now, the couple of things that could tilt it one way or the other.
We celebrate such mediocrity in this country. At least we didn't get downgraded.
At least we didn't get further downgraded to
a matric pass rate went up, even though half of the matrics who were in high school 2 years ago didn't even write matric. But, you know, we're doing great. Let's celebrate.
Yes. So if we take a look in terms of the ratings agencies, I think that if we are digging our heels in terms of what happens with SAA, that's going to be a positive in terms of the ratings agencies. Mm. Eskom is definitely a negative in terms of the ratings agencies. And the question of how much can actually be achieved between now and that budget speech is going to be absolutely crucial in terms of how the ratings agencies are going to view that. If the ratings agencies take us down even further, then we end up with major cuck, because then it means that we automatically end up get taken off the list of safe havens where people are able to invest their bond money.
Mm. And then that means for us higher interest rates.
It means higher interest rates, and yeah. It means
so
that
for individuals, it's going to mean if you owe money, you're in big trouble.
Yes.
Which most of us in this country do.
Yeah. So that, from an economic perspective, I would say that everything is going to hinge on to what extent we can get Eskom at least on track. And when I say on track, what this means is that if we have a situation where we have firm deadlines in place of actually splitting up Eskom into those three separate entities, each of which is then held accountable in terms of particular performance goals, I think that the ratings agencies will then turn around and say, okay, we'll give you guys some breathing space, which is the best that we can hope for around that. The more crucial point for me is what happens with the DA. Now, the DA is imploding. If you there's no other
is
way.
Is that a present participle? Imploding is imploding. I think it already has.
No. Remember, imploding is a slow process. And we're watching this entire thing happening in slow motion. But at the point at which John Moody turns around and last week and distances. No, it wasn't last week. It was earlier this week. Distances the DA in Gauteng from the tweets of Helen Ziller.
Right.
And immediately you see this is a party that is actually now pulling itself apart. And they're heading for their Congress, I think it's called.
That's right.
In next month, yeah. Which is where they're actually going to elect
the leader.
The leader that's actually going to carry them forward. Now, if I look in terms of what the DA has to offer, it's very much the same that what the ANC has to offer. There isn't anyone that actually stands out as being truly inspiring, where the people of this country can rally around and say, hey, you know what, let's actually put our trust in this person who actually has enough insight and enough inspiration
to
actually take us forward.
So my favorite term that I've seen in reference to the DA is self-immolating, which is what I think that they're just pouring petrol on themselves. And it's intensely scary to watch, because one of the things that I'm very fascinated to see this year in the political front is what happens with, there's quite a lot of by-elections, but also because we're going into local government elections next year in 2021. And this year is important to see how the people on the ground are deciding what happens in their little municipalities. And that is going to be a big kind of show of what we're going to see in 2021 in the local government elections. And what happens in the local government elections shows us what happens in the national election coming up, and the DA. Well, and we're going to see the EFF growing. We're going to see the EFF growing, and that is
let's just park the EFF for a for a while. But Pumi is absolutely right in terms of watching the by-elections. Now, the reason why watching the by-elections is significant is because you are now seeing the impact upon the DA of Musi's dick move with regard to Patricia de Lille. So the DA has now been losing by-elections in the Western Cape in previously safe havens. And the reason for that is because the Good Party has been also contesting those constituencies. So they've effectively been splitting what used to be the DA's safe vote, which means that those constituencies have ended up going to the ANC. We're going to be seeing a lot more of that. Unless we can get to a point where the DA is actually speaking with one voice again and is actually offering a credible alternative.
Do you think Helen Ziller has finally done too much, that even people who were holding out some hope that she could rebuild? No, because they were. There were people who were saying that actually she's a principled person. She's, you know, got a liberal Democrat brain. She was a good leader at the time that she was the leader. She increased their share of votes. She did a lot for the party, but she's a spent force now in many people's opinions.
I think that's spin, and I think that's spin that's coming mainly from within the DA factions. Let's be very clear. There are these two very profound groupings that are currently within the DA. But
because she's still hugely influential.
Yes. But the question is whether she's going to be hugely influential enough in terms of the Congress that goes down in February to be able to put the party back on track.
Pumi, do you think she's finally put her foot in her mouth for the last time and now she has no credibility? Or do you think that, that there's still a chance she can play a positive role in the DA? What do you think, Pums?
I don't know why we're passing this to Pumi. I don't believe she's got
a positive role to play.
I don't believe that she's put a foot in her mouth. I believe she's said things that piss off people. That's not putting your foot in your mouth. Pissing off people comes with the territory. I think that that's something that's essential. The question is whether there's a sufficient body of people who are going to respond to the fact that she is sticking to her guns. Boris Johnson has shown us that, in fact, that is the case. You need to be aware of the fact that no matter what sort of hoo-ha comes down in terms of outrage around what people are saying, behind the scenes, voters will actually turn around and say, no, actually, I fully support what this person is doing, even though other people think that it happens to be outrageous. And we should not be falling into this trap of assuming.
Well, that's why I'm asking.
Yeah. So there are definitely two things with what Canton is saying. That's how the party sees, and we know that the party, except for some people every now and again distancing themselves from Helen, the party loves Helen. They love her. That's why they keep electing her into these positions. Even, you know, after she said, I'm retiring, she comes back, right?
I like that impression.
But the party likes Helen. The problem with the party liking Helen is that the voting public does not like a party that likes this Helen. So,
well, we will only find that outcome next elections.
But
that's my point.
So, but my thing is when we see what's happening at the by-election space, is they're losing that ground, and it's because the people are going.
Canton did very carefully reference that it's happening in the Western Cape, and it's as a result of what happened to Patricia DeLille that they've lost that foothold. That's got nothing to do with Helen Ziller. That's as a mistake under Musi.
And we still don't know the truth,
which none of us understood.
Of what happened there.
There was no due process in terms of DeLille's removal.
I just remember poor old Patricia DeLille on TV showing us her security gates. That's all I remembered.
But it's happening in KZN too.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not in the Western Cape, it's happening because of Patricia DeLille and a split vote. But it is they're losing ground in other areas too. You know, so it's happening in KZN as well.
Your ward just changed back to the ANC or something?
No, my ward didn't.
But of course the ANC are in charge in this province, in this city.
Well, the ANC are in charge of Johannesburg, yes. For now.
And you were actually saying that's fine by you as long as the potholes get fixed.
As long as the potholes get fixed, as long as the traffic lights work, yeah, as long as the grass is cut.
And you said actually that was better under the ANC this time around.
No, I'm saying that happened very quickly. About a week after the ANC came to power, those things happen in quick succession.
Is that still the case?
No, it's not the case. It's not the case. Okay. The traffic lights are once again out of action at the intersection of Woodmead and Pretoria Main Road.
Okay.
The potholes are back in their numbers, and hey, you know, it's okay. But again, going forward, you know, putting on the whole Nostradamus hat. Okay, let's also not forget that we now have Herman Mashaba and Musi Maimane, who I'm, you know, speaking of together loosely in this thing, because I think that they are going to end up in some sort of partnership together. Right now, we have the scenario where Mashaba has been testing the waters at a number of levels and asking questions. Is it safe to say that they will re-enter politics as a separate entity? I think the answer to that is yes.
Yeah.
Now, and if you look in terms of who they are going to take votes from, they're not going to take votes from the DA. They're going to take votes from the ANC.
Not convinced.
Yeah, because essentially, look, there.
So you know that
Musi was always positioning himself kind of as an ANC light, you know. So in other words, broadly embracing a lot of the stuff that's in the Freedom Charter, but with the whole idea, hey, we're not corrupt.
Yeah, showing his true political colors, you know, that actually my ambition is to be this thing, and I know I can't do it within the ANC. My ambition is to be the premier, to be the president, all of that kind of stuff. But actually, I don't have enough of the metal to go into the main party that I really want to be in and take on the individuals that are sitting in there and make it happen, right?
So are you talking about
Musi?
You're thinking DA or ANC?
Both. So the DA, the reason why he was positioning himself as what Kenton calls the ANC light,
yeah,
is because he had a better chance within the DA,
yeah,
of getting to the top than he ever did or ever can have within the ANC structure.
Do you agree with Kenton saying that they'll if they do establish themselves as a party, they'll take votes from the ANC, not the DA?
Yeah, I'm not convinced. They may, but it won't be enough. It won't be enough.
It's not going to be enough, but that's not the point.
So the thing about it is also that Herman Mashaba, who spent almost all his time
as the mayor, telling us he's doing this
because he's not a politician.
He's tasted
the power, and now he wants to be a politician.
Guys, we're getting drawn into the personalities. You see, the point is, this is not about Herman. It is not about Musi. It is not about Helen. It's a question of where the realignments are likely to come from. And I'm saying that the one realignment that's likely to come, well, firstly, the DA, we need to see what actually goes down next month. And if Helen is able to effectively take control of the party, and she's able to impose her will upon the party, and I'm not sure that she has enough support within the party to do that at this point. But if she is able to, then we are going to see one course correction. We will once again see the DA kind of pulling back onto that trajectory that started under Tony Leon and that was continued under Helen. You'll probably see voters that ended up going to the Freedom Front Plus then swinging back in the direction of the DA. You will then see people who were supporting Musi going to vote for Musi, because remember that they voted for Musi not because they supported the DA, but because they were supporting Musi. Because if you looked drill down in terms of the numbers, Musi actually pulled fewer votes overall than Helen Zille did. So now, if Musi and Herman are repositioning themselves as an alternative to the ANC, a non-corrupt alternative to the ANC, and look, I think apart from that issue that we had around Musi's vehicle grand corruption doesn't really hang over either Herman or Musi. And I think that, you know, for people who are disillusioned ANC voters who, you know, look askance upon, you know, 108 birthday celebrations when salaries are not being paid, I think they are the type of people who would be likely to vote. Not at the same level of numbers that vote for the EFF,
sure,
but they are likely to still vote, and enough to give
Kenton,
some
but you
seat.
Cannot start your statement out by saying let's not get drawn into the personalities and then continue to say that people will vote for Musi and Herman because they offer Musi and Herman offer a different perspective.
Well, I'm talking about the message rather than the personal.
But also, I think from your personal experience, you know that starting a political party and getting sufficient traction to make a dent is a very, very hard thing to do. And between Musi and Herman,
Pumi, we started a political party 5 weeks ahead of the elections. Okay, and if you, in terms of making a dent, all right. Remember that the ZACP took out Akhang, okay, pulled more votes than Akhang. In 5 weeks, the ZACP pulled more votes than Akhang. In 5 weeks, the ZACP pulled more votes than a ZAPO. If you consider what had happened if that entity had actually been formed 6 months prior, traction would have been far more substantial, because I think that people were looking for alternatives at that particular point, and probably still are looking for alternatives.
And these guys
I'm not saying sufficient attraction.
I'm saying sure. No, but, I'm but saying they are known quantities, these two. So you talk about the politics and, of personality.
And sufficient traction again. Remember, in terms of the EFF is a huge success story at that level.
Mm,
if you consider the short period in which the EFF was able to gain sufficient traction by building coherence around a particular message was huge. I disagree with you, though, that the EFF is going to substantially increase its footprint going ahead in the next elections, mainly because the ANC has kneecapped them to some extent by adopting a lot of the platforms that the EFF was previously pushing. So the extent to which they're able to lose support to the EFF, I mean, what is the EFF's message going into the next election that's going to be significantly different from the ANC's message? And remember, the other point that was crucial as well is that the ANC showed effectively in terms of Johannesburg that actually they don't need the support of the EFF in order to govern the city of Johannesburg. So now suddenly the rules of engagement have changed. The EFF were previously seeing themselves as kingmakers, and we now realize in terms of the rules, no, they're actually not quite the kingmakers that they assumed that they were previously. If you look in terms of the city of Johannesburg, the EFF did not win a single ward overall. They only have proportional representation in Johannesburg. So, but going back to the whole question of realignment, okay, so my predictions are going to be that if the DA course corrects and Helen Zille effectively ends up taking control of the party, the DA will emerge stronger. If Helen Zille loses her support, the DA is going to crumble. If the DA crumbles, the support that the DA currently has is going to go to the Freedom Front Plus, because it has the Freedom Front Plus has positioned itself right now as the only principled space that voters can actually rely on to some extent. At the same time, you're going to have a Herman slash Musi scenario where they end up putting in place a new party, and that new party is going to then take a significant number of seats, enough to make a difference in particular constituencies. But are they going to be a game changer at the level of the EFF? No, no way. But they are going to take votes away primarily from the ANC. But the local government elections coming up now is not actually important. What is going to be important is how the economy actually performs, and that all ties in with February. Let's see where it goes.
Well, I hate to break it to you two, but we've already run out of time. When you started this morning, you had no comment to make on the first two stories, and then from there on, you had only comments to make, which
well,
is great.
Well, you guys kept wanting to ask me what is going on at my personal life, and that's so dull.
I know.
You guys.
Mina, not him.
You guys.
All right.
At least Pumi didn't
Pumelele,
say
Bona. I'm so glad you could join us this morning. Canton, I'm so glad you could join us this morning. Thank you. If you've enjoyed this, you can listen to it again. If you'd like to pass it on to people, The Burning Platform is available as a podcast all on its own on cliffcentral.com, as are all of our shows. Go and take a listen there. See what you like and pass it on to people who you think will enjoy it too. Thank you so much. We will see you tomorrow between 6 and 8 o'clock. Be good. CliffCentral.com.